anybody to come before the portfolio committee for oral submissions after this week's process. We then received, like I've said, 11 substantive submissions. 10 of the 11 indicated interest to come before the portfolio committee to make oral submissions. We therefore are going to have 10 organizations or individuals that we'll be interacting with between today and tomorrow. We had set 4 days for oral submissions, which if there were many could have started yesterday, today, Wednesday and Thursday. But because we received very few of them and we thought it's possible to have this today and tomorrow, we've done exactly that. But also I must indicate that I think about 8 of the 10 wanted to appear before us tomorrow, which is Wednesday. We therefore had to request at least 2 to come today so that we do not have an overcrowding tomorrow, our public hearings, because they did not want to come on this day. I think it's because of the fact that this day is preceding a public holiday on Friday. So this is the process that will be unfolding before us here in the House. Can I mention the fact that we understand the issues and probably the emotions that go with this bill? But my request as the chairperson is that we deal with this where we disagree honorably so, with respect, so that we can then be in a position as the portfolio committee to go ahead with the work that is before us. And it is this portfolio committee that takes its work very seriously. Let me therefore welcome also members of the public and those that are going to make submissions. The Department of Police, I can also see the lawyer from the Department of Justice, the Secretariat, the head of the Hawks, General Dramat. You are most welcome to the meeting. We also have the legal section of Parliament here represented. We are happy that you are here. We'll allow our researchers to take us through the submissions. Then after a minute at 11:30, we'll then have our very first submission. In fact, I think it is at 11:45. Yes, the first submission will then commence at that time. We will wish that we keep to time where possible, but will not actually be forcing people to rush, but we will indeed request that we keep to time. We have made arrangements with Parliament in case we take longer than expected, that we be provided with transport, and therefore members will indeed be provided with transport in an event we go beyond the allocated time. And therefore we'll have time to do our work and do it thoroughly. I will hand over now to I take it that people know me, I'm Cindy Chikunga. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. And these are the members of the Portfolio Committee who I think we all know will therefore go on to hand over to the parliamentary researchers. Over to you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and members of the committee, members of the public. I will go through the analysis of the submitted bill and also the summary of the written submissions. I'm just quickly going through the introduction and how the Hawks Bill was established. We all know that the disbanding of Directorate for Special Operations, commonly known as the Scorpions, in early 2009 was met with a great deal of controversy. And the Scorpions was publicly regarded as the elite law enforcement unit mandated to combat corruption in South Africa. However, the effective functioning of the Scorpions was called into question, and thus a decision was reached to create a new anti-corruption unit through the South African Amendment Act, number 37 of 2008. And the amendments were included in Chapter 6 of the South African Police Service Act, number 68 of 1995, and effectively established the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. commonly known as the Hall. Subsequent to this, Mr. Hugh Glenister challenged the Act on constitutional grounds and had a constitutional court case, which was, judgment was delivered on 17 March 2011, and the judgment was suspended for 18 months to afford Parliament the opportunity to amend the bill. The Constitutional Court posed two main questions to be determined regarding the constitutional integrity of the 2008 First Amendment Act. Firstly, whether the Constitution requires the state to establish and maintain an independent institution or unit to combat corruption and organized crime, on which the Court found that the Constitution does impose an obligation to the state to establish and maintain an independent body to combat corruption and organized crime, and secondly, whether the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation meets the requirements of independence, on which the Court found that the Directorate did not disclose adequate safeguards to ensure independence. And the Constitutional Court further focused on three main aspects of the unlawful legislation, namely the operational and structural independence of the DPCI and whether this conforms to the requirements set for an anti-corruption agency. Secondly, the security of tenure and remuneration was discussed, and thirdly, the accountability and oversight by the Ministerial Committee, which was found to undermine the independence of the DPCI. The major amendment that was made through the new Act that is before us today were addressed in three main areas. The first one was to provide the Parliament with a greater degree of oversight. The most apparent measures of oversight afforded to Parliament are scrutiny over annual reports, budget allocations, annual performance plans, and strategic plans of the Department of Police. Also, the fact that the Minister must report to Parliament on the appointment of the head of the DPCI within 14 days of such appointment. Thirdly, the allowance made for the Minister of Police to submit the remuneration scale payable to the head, deputy head, and provincial head to Parliament for approval, and further, that such remuneration scale may not be reduced except with the concurrence of Parliament. Fourthly, provision is made that the policy guidelines for the DPCI, as drafted by the Minister of Police, must be approved by Parliament, and provision is made for Parliament to concur with the policy guidelines for the selection of national priority offences as drafted by the Minister of Police. The second major amendment is with the bill to attempt to address the security of tenure and remuneration through the insertion of Section 17CA in the Act 68 of 1995, as provided for in Clause 6 of the bill, in that it provides for a non-renewable fixed-term appointment not exceeding 7 years for the head, deputy head, and provincial head of the Directorate. It also makes provision for the remuneration, allowances, and other conditions of service for the head, deputy head, and provincial head of the Directorate. The amendment bill attempts to address concerns raised regarding the possible political interference in the Directorate through the Ministerial Committee in several ways. Through Clause 12 of the bill, it is provided that the Ministerial Committee is no longer mandated to determine the policy guidelines for selection of national priority offences and policy guidelines for the referral to cases by the National Commissioner, and also that the Ministerial Committee may no longer oversee the functioning of the Directorate. Accordingly, almost all functions and powers of the Ministerial Committee is removed through this bill. When we look at the clauses, Clause 1 and 2 seek to align the amendment bill with the current constitution as it is previously based on the interim constitution, and this will also be largely addressed through the white paper before Parliament next year. Clause 3 broadly speaks to the authority of the head. The head of the directorate is afforded more responsibility in the content of personnel and the allocation of resources to the directorate. One concern that could be raised in this clause is that it basically takes away all the authority of the National Commission of Police out of the directorate, and that it could be seen as contradictory to the Constitution of South Africa. Section 207 makes the National Commissioner the ultimate head of the feds. And if you exclude any functions from him or her, it could be seen against the Constitution. Also, it says that the head of the directorate will have the final say if there is a dispute between him or herself and the provincial commissioner. It must be cleared up whether or what process will be followed when such a dispute arises between the head and the provincial commissioner. Clause 4 of the Act basically relates to the location of the directorate. It is now a directorate in the service, the South African Police Service. It is not uncommon to have anti-corruption agencies established as units, as part of law enforcement agencies. The directorate performs a separate program, and Program 6, in the South African Police Service. Clause 5 speaks to the establishment and composition of the directorate. The head is appointed as the Deputy National Commissioner within the Police Service. The Minister appoints the head of the directorate with concurrence of Cabinet. It could be seen as a concern that there is a lack of criteria for appointment. However, one must acknowledge that it will be in the best interest for the Minister of Police to appoint an appropriate candidate, as the political elite will share in the successes of the directorate. The minister must also report to Parliament on the appointment, and one must also just seek clarity on the report, on the fact that the minister reports to Parliament. One must seek clarity if there is any recourse for Parliament if members feel that the person appointed is wholly unfit for the position. The head is currently now appoints the deputy national head and provincial head, and it is no longer appointed by the national commissioner. Focus must also be placed on specialized training for the members of the directorate, as the appropriate training of members hinges the success of the directorate. Clause 6, basically it gives the insertion of Section 17CA into the Act, and it speaks towards the appointment, remuneration and conditions of service for members of the directorate. This was one of the major concerns in the Glenister judgment, and it has been addressed by the amendment bill in the following ways. Provision is made for the head, deputy head and provincial head, and their remuneration, appointment and conditions of service is stipulated in the Act. However, no provision is made for the rest of the ordinary members, which could be seen as a concern. The terms of the contract of a non-renewable 7-year contract do not provide for a minimum period of appointment. which can be arguably a cause for concern, as the head of the directorate can be arguably appointed for 2 years. And so it is recommended that a minimum period also be stated in the bill, for instance, 5 to 7 years appointment. The minister, as stated earlier, must report to Parliament on the appointment of the head. It must be, clarity must be attained by the members of the committee whether Parliament will have any recourse if members feel that the appointment is not suitable, as it is only in concurrence with Parliament and Parliament need not approve it. It is it was submitted by many of the written submissions that the appointment of the executive or of the head must be made in the same manner as the executive of Chapter 9 institution by the President or Parliament. And the remuneration scale as stipulated in the bill can only be amended through the approval of Parliament, which provides an adequate safeguard for the security of tenure. Clause 7 speaks towards the identification of priority grants, the mandate of the directorate, and policy guidelines. Provision is made for the head to identify national priority offences, where previously it was stated that the minister will identify these. Policy guidelines is to be drawn up by the minister and no longer the ministerial committee. It must be indicated that the process, the parliamentary process in dealing with committees as opposed to individuals is very different, which is a very good safeguard for included in the bill, because the minister is held accountable to a specific committee, whereas the intersectorial committee is not held accountable in the same way to any parliamentary structure. The policy guidelines, as drawn up by the minister, must also be approved by Parliament, which is also seen as a very good safeguard. Reference is made to Chapter 2 and Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. It is recommended that these offences be clearly stipulated in the bill to prevent unnecessary cross-referencing between the acts. Clause 8 speaks towards the loss of confidence in the head of the directorate. It states that the head of the directorate can be removed from office on several grounds. It is also pending on inquiry. It is not certain whether the inquiry is going to be done by an independent body or the minister or someone maybe in his office. So that must be clarified to just make sure who's going to actually do the inquiry. The fact that the head of the directorate could be suspended without any salary could be seen as a concern, as this arguably could be seen as a preemptive punishment to the head. The wording loss of confidence could be subjective and based on non-objective principles, which must also be just scrutinized further. Parliament must be notified in writing regarding the removal of the head of the directorate, and it must also be clarified whether Parliament will have any further say in in the removal or if the job for notification. Section 17DAC states that both houses can pray for the removal of the head. It's not certain whether this is the incorrect use of terminology, but the concern regarding this is that the wording pray actually supersedes the provision made for inquiry into the fitness of the head, and I've said that if both houses pray for the removal of the head, he or she could be removed without any inquiry done. Clause 9 of the Act speaks towards the security clearance that needs to be allocated to the members of the directorate. It is internationally agreed, accepted for personnel to be subjected to security clearance investigation. However, the concern with this is that there is no recourse available if security clearance of security agencies denies or degrades clearance, as they are not legally bounded to state the reasons why. Excuse me. Why security clearance has been denied. The oath of affirmation, it is not a legally binding document, and it is suggested that clarity be sought on this. It is a good safeguard that is built into the bill. However, one would like to see a bit more binding for the members to do the investigations without fear or favour or any prejudge. Clause 10 of the bill speaks towards the secondment of the personnel, and it affords the head of the directorate substantially more influence in appointing his or her team in terms of the secondment of the personnel to the directorate. And this is also in line with international requirements to to appoint personnel from a wide pool of expertise and insight and knowledge into a variety of government departments. Clause 11 of the bill speaks towards the finances and financial accountability of the directors. It states that the National Commissioner of Police will remain the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA. Concern is raised about the control of finances, as it is argued that that the finances being controlled by the National Commissioner makes him or the ultimate authority on the directorate. It is stated in the bill that the monies allocated to the directorate will be earmarked funds, which basically means that the funds allocated to the directorate can only be used for services provided by the directorate. So that is a very good safeguard. It also states that consultation on the budget is made or the allocation. The National Commissioner basically decides on the budget allocations after consultation with the head of the DPCI. It is arguable that it should be that the head is more involved in and that it is rather in consultation with the National Commissioner in allocating funds. Clause 12 of the bill speaks towards the Ministerial Committee. It removes virtually all powers previously given to the Ministerial Committee in that it no longer determines policy guidelines. It no longer determines priority offences and it no longer determines guidelines for referral of priority crimes. It basically states that the minister takes final responsibility for the law. It could be argued that the ministerial committee should be removed in its entirety, as the minister could take responsibility for intersectoral collaboration during usual cabinet meetings. Reference also made that the head of the directorate must report to the ministerial committee on performance and implementation reports, and it should be clarified what is meant by the performance and implementation report. Clause 13 speaks of the operational committee. It is unclear what the function of the operational committee is exactly. It states that the operational committee shall review, monitor, and facilitate the support and assistance of the respective government departments or institutions to the directorate and address problems which arise regarding such support and assistance. Thus, the sole responsibility of the operational committee is to ensure intersectorial operational coordination and cooperation. The additional motivation for the need of the structure should be provided. Clause 14 of the bill speaks towards the policy guidelines of the directorate. It says that the directorate will be formed into a separate program of the South African Police Service and will be subjected to the same standard of oversight currently endowed to the service through scrutiny of budgets, strategic plans, annual performance plans, and annual reports. Policy guidelines drafted in concurrence of Parliament instead of approval of Parliament should be scrutinized for more. There is a discrepancy between concurrence and approval and should be clarified. Clause 15 of the bill speaks towards the retired judge. It was included as a safeguard to secure that members is not influenced politically or coerced into doing or following orders that they need not. The proposed amendments to Section 17L of the Act seeks to provide the directorate with a safeguard against undue political interference and allows the retired judge to conduct an investigation on alleged interference, and further allows the judge to request and obtain information from the Director of Public Prosecutions in the event of such investigation. However, it is arguable that the safeguard does not prevent interference, but merely deals with such possible interference after the occurrence of the incident. Clause 16 of the Act speaks towards command and control. Members of the Directorate will remain members of the South African Police Service with all the same powers, duties and functions of other members of the South African Police Service. These members are still governed by the SAPS Act, number 68 of 1995, unless stipulated differently in the Amendment Act. One might argue that this opens members to the same hierarchical structure of the service, which might be deemed as a constriction to the structural independence of the directorate and susceptible to undue interference and pressure from the top. The South African Police Service Act makes provisions in Section 47(1) that a member shall not obey a patently unlawful order or instruction and may request that such order be given to a member in writing. Thus, if a member of the directorate feels that he or she is intimidated provision is made through the retired judge when such member feels that they are given an illegal instruction, he or she may refuse to execute such order. Clause 17 of the bill speaks towards the transitional arrangement, a provision for all investigations or prosecutions currently conducted or pending will not be affected by the amendments made to the Act, and that it in no way affects the validity of said investigations. The currently serving head, deputy head, and provincial heads of the directorate will serve their current position until the proposed amendments of the Act commences and appointments will be made in terms of Section 17CA of the Amendment Act. Further clarity should be sought on how the stability of the unit in terms of human resources will be ensured once the bill has been acted. Although Clause 17 makes provision for transitional arrangements, currently serving members of the DPCI will experience a large degree of uncertainty regarding their futures. We can now discuss the summary of the written submission. The committee received a total of 21 written submissions, of which 10 were substantial for oral presentations. All of the submissions, save one, indicated that the bill is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment. We received one late submission from the Centre of Constitutional Rights, which will be considered for oral presentation. The submissions that were identified for oral presentation was that of Professor Pierre Decaux and the UNISA College of Law, the Institute for Security Studies, and IFAIFA, the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum, the Alan Guzman Foundation, Professor Muangu from collaboration between the Open Society Foundation, Legal Resource Center, and Corruption Watch, the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, and the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. And the following section just provides a broad overview of the submissions received. And it will not contain what was the actual amendments made to the clauses, which will be discussed later. Professor Pierre de Vos basically submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment, in that he looked at basically the duty of the state to set up a concrete and effective mechanism to fight corruption. He looked at the operational independence of the DPCI, in that it should be free of undue political interference relating to the appointment of members, security of tenure, and remuneration not attained. And also the structural independence of the DPCI, which relates to the healthy relationship between the directorate and the legislature and its executive. Oversight over the body and accountability to the two political branches of government was not attained. The University of South Africa College of Law submitted that the bill does not address the notion of an independent anti-corruption institution. They submitted that the 7-year non-renewable term of appointment is problematic. The head remains a deputy national commissioner, yet other deputy national commissioners will have different terms and conditions of work. They also submitted that different procedures for suspension and removal of the head to other deputy national commissioners is a problem, They submitted that it is inappropriate to establish an institution within another institution. They also stated that it is unclear area of focus in the identification of serious or the priority crimes in that serious organized crime, serious commercial crime, and serious corruption should be better defined and not so broadly stated. The unit should report directly to Parliament and not to ministers to give more safeguards against political interference. The submission provides details of international anti-corruption agencies, including Hong Kong and Botswana, which is the universal model with investigative, preventative, and communicative functions. Singapore, which is investigative model, New South Wales, which is a parliamentary model, and the United States of America, which is multi-agency model. The Institute for Security Studies also submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the Genesis judgment. They identified the location of the DPCI within that as a concern towards adequate independence. Their memorandum accompanying the bill argues that the Constitution requires the curation an adequate independent anti-corruption unit. It also requires that a member of cabinet must be responsible for policing. That meant that the statement conflates policing with the activities of an anti-corruption agency. It is argued that there exists no requirement why the director must fall under the responsibility of the Minister of Police. The subordination of the head as Deputy National Commissioner under the National Commissioner remains a concern. In addition, the fact that the National Commissioner remains the accounting officer of the Directorate is also raised as a major concern. The appointment and dismissal of the head of the head and other staff of the Directorate does not provide structural and operational independence, which was required by the Constitutional Court. They further submitted that oversight and accountability of the Directorate is undermined, and the mandate of the Directorate is not clearly defined. The Institute for Accountability in Southern Africa, IFISA, also submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment. They argue that independence is not attained, that specialization in corruption fighting is not included in the bill. They said that proper resourcing of the specialist body created by way of a guaranteed budget is not provided for. And they said that appropriate training of personnel is lacking, and the security of tenure to insulate against political interference is not attained. The organization stated that the existence of an independent NPA in Chapter 8 of the Constitution will be complemented by an anti-corruption commission to be established under Chapter 9 of the Constitution. The anti-corruption commission is not needed to be given prosecutory powers, but mechanism needs to be devised to resolve any possible disagreement between the NPA and the Anti-Corruption Commission on the face of the corruption docket presented by the latter to the former. The submission they made mentioned several international conventions ratified against corruption. It illustrates the link between corruption and organized crime and human rights violations. It further makes mention to the impact of corruption and organized crime on human rights. It argues that the combating of corruption requires an independent body and lists six international convention signed and ratified by South Africa with an explanatory section of each. The organization submitted a proposed constitutional amendment to establish an anti-corruption commission, which prepares for the constitutional amendments for the commission under Chapter 9 of the Constitution. The organization furthermore submitted a replacement anti-corruption bill as opposed to the current bill under scrutiny for consideration. The replacement bill proposes the establishment of an anti-corruption agency as a Chapter 9 institution. The African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum submitted that the bill on scrutiny is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment. The head of the DPC, they argue that the head of the DPCI as Deputy National Commissioner remains subordinate to the National Commissioner of Police. The lack of financial independence as the National Commissioner drafts the budget after consultation with the head instead of in consultation with the head is also argued as a problem. They argued that the DPCI mandate is too loosely defined and needs to be more defined. They also argued that the veto rights held by the minister on the appointment of the deputy head as the DPCI of the DPCI is problematic. They also submitted that the removal of the head through an inquiry is too loosely defined. The possibility that the National Commissioner may transfer any individual, or if such a person cannot be redeployed elsewhere, and even maybe discharge such a person if his or her clearance is degraded, withdrawn, or refused on reasonable grounds is a concern. It is unclear whether all personnel of the DPCI must have security clearance, and the reason for clearance not clearly stated, and note that nothing inherently relates to national security in the investigation of corruption, and the overgeneralization of clearance requirements is unnecessary and may open the system up for abuse. Lastly, they submitted that the removal of power from the Ministerial Committee to the Minister of Police does not address the threat of political interference. The Helen Zussman Foundation submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment. They submitted to comply that in order to comply with the constitutional judgment and achieve adequate independence, the DPCI and its head cannot fall under the control of the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service. They argue that legislation that brings into being a body within the South African Police Service that does not fall under the control of the National Commissioner is unconstitutional in terms of Section 207 of the Constitution. The process of interviewing and recommendation for the position of the head of the DPCI should be done by an independent body and deferred to the relevant minister for final decision. All the heads should be appointed by Parliament as with Chapter 9 institutions. They also submitted that security of tenure to protect the job security of the directorate members can relatively easily provided by a fixed non-renewable term of employment or an indefinite contract of employment. They submitted that the directorate should be solely responsible for the determining of which offences and cases should be investigated by the DPCI, and that it is proposed that the head should draft the guidelines in this regard, and Parliament should consider and approve him. They further submitted that the criteria for appointment of the head of the directorate should be vigorous and substantive. They also submitted that the financial management must be in the hands of the head of the directorate and not the National Police Commissioner. And finally, they submitted that the issue of security clearance is problematic and needs to be clarified and not subjected to the arbitrary exercise of power. Professor Mahangul submitted that the bill is consistent with the plaintiff's judgment. He submitted that the location of the directorate is irrelevant as long as it remains independent. He submitted that security of tenure is addressed in the bill through the renewable term of appointment in the Act, which is now replaced by the non-renewable term. He also states that security of tenure was addressed by statutory salaries for the head and deputy head of the DVCI included as required. He submitted that the ground for removal of the head is adequately redefined and that the oath of office to be taken by members introduced, which binds personnel to conduct their duties independently. He further submitted that the powers of the ministerial committee is reduced to prevent political interference and that no need is seen for the creation of a Chapter 9 institution to fight corruption as the bill is sufficient or provides sufficient independence towards the DPCI. The Open Society Foundation, Legal Resources Center and Corruption Watch submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the plaintiff's judgment. They argue on two grounds, namely the lack of security of tenure and the lack of accountability. The main point on the lack of security of tenure is regarding the appointment and renewal of tenure, the remuneration and conditions of service, discipline and removal of the head. The lack of accountability is argued in terms of the determination of policy guidelines and reporting to Parliament, financial accountability, and the security clearance requirements for all staff members. The Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution submitted that the bill is inconsistent with the plaintiff's judgment. They argue that the location of the unit within SAP is not acceptable. They argue that the institutional protections for a general nature against political interference is not sufficiently provided for. They submitted that the mandate of the unit is not clearly defined. They also argue that the criteria and procedure for the appointment of key and other staff is not provided for. They argue that the security of tenure is not sufficiently provided for, that provisions and process of dismissal is not sufficiently provided for, the lack of minimum secured remuneration levels is a concern. The role of the ministerial committee as left in the bill is not clear. They also argue that sufficient accountability is not secured in the directorate and that the maintenance of a budget and financial control in the authority of the National Commissioner is inconsistent with adequate independence. The Association of Certified Fraud Examiners submitted that the bill does not address issues raised in the Gleaners' judgment. They argue that insufficient independence regarding the degree of management by political actors is a concern. They indicated that the directorate had insufficient specialization and was thus not maintain a dedicated anti-corruption entity. They argue that the directorate will have insufficient security of tenure in terms of appointment and discharge, in terms of secured remuneration levels, in terms of continued coordination by ministerial committee, the potential low level of parliamentary oversight, and complaints mechanism reactive rather than proactive. The association recommends the creation of a dedicated anti-corruption entity as a Chapter 9 institution and a constitutional amendment to facilitate this. And that is the 10 submissions that we will hear for oral presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the presentation. This is the report presented to us by our researchers. First, their own version. Summarization in the bill, but also the submissions that we've received. I will allow members to ask clarity seeking questions. And I'm saying clarity seeking questions because we cannot ask a question like, why do you say this bill is independent? Because they have not said that. So, or not independent, I mean, is in line with the judgment or not in line with the judgment. Why is Professor DeForce saying it's not in line with, because Professor DeForce will be here to make a presentation on his submission, so they cannot respond on their behalf. What they've done here is just to summarize some of the presentations that we're going to get today or submissions that we're going to get today and tomorrow. However, we can ask clarity-seeking questions on what they've presented and probably their own version of the bill itself. Honorable Ndlovu, Honorable Ramatlakane, Honorable Annelies, in that order.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much to the researcher for the presentation. I think it has made the work easier by following what she has already done. I just want to ask, maybe it will be one question, but maybe it's a loaded question. accountability. We talk about accountability and oversight of a ministerial committee. It seems as if every now and then somebody is referring to it every now and then, although in a different manner. But in your presentation, you find that maybe it undermines the independence of the DPCI. Can you just elaborate on that? I think it will be loaded because you will find it in all the presentation and other presentation chapters. They talk about this ministerial committee and so on and so forth, and the function thereof and so on, while you pronounce on it. Can you just elaborate on it? That's the first question. The last question is that the amendment itself, will seek to have an independent. But in your point of view, does independent mean excluding the minister, the parliament, or the ministerial committee? Those are 3 points that I wanted to raise. The minister, the parliament, which is us, and the ministerial committee. Does that exclude those three people if you talk about independence? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and the researchers' work that they've done. I have maybe just 3 questions, preliminary questions. The first one is in terms of the submission received. You do mention that 21 written submissions were received, but however the 10 were substantial for oral submission. I just want to check from the researcher. In reviewing the whole totality of the 21, and I'm asking this question based on what you've just presented. Seems to be a general trend running of inconsistency with the judgment, So the remaining 11 of those that perhaps are not, what is your take in assessing this trend of judgment, constitutional judgment on it? If you could just explain that. The second part, Chair, is the also just I wanted to find out in terms of there seems to be a trend running that speaks to independence as well as the Chapter 9 institution. And Chapter 9 institution, has it been argued in terms of this? Now, in general, assessing the work that has been done there, what is your finding on the 11 others? The third one is the independency insofar as the National Commission is concerned. In relation to that, as well as the judgment itself, is the judgment arguing or presenting independency outside of the National Commission as it stands currently, or is it trying to go back to what Scorpion used to be in terms of the independency? I just want to try and find out this issue about the National Commissioner, accounting to National Commissioner and lack of independency, and the previous, how the Scorpion was structured, including the budget issue, the issue of budget after consultation, not in consultation. Is that in pursuance of the total independence as you see it in terms of the budget input itself? So those are the 3 questions that I just want to understand, Honorable Chair, from the researcher. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Citizen. Just a question in terms of there are some of the submissions that refer to other international models. Did you have a look at those international models and if we can get some feedback on that? If not, during our procedures, if you can have a look for us at those other international models. I think it's Botswana specifically, as well as I can't remember the other one now. If you can just have a look at those for us as well. And then in terms of did I understand you correctly that you are saying, I mean, I saw that as well, but that it's inconsistent, that many of these, in your summary of the submission, says it's inconsistent constitutionally, even though the court expressed itself that it's not a problem that it is within the SAPS. Am I understanding you correct?
Just one question of clarity for the researchers, Chair. The proposal that there is a retired judge, for members to approach, should they perhaps feel the weight of political interference. Now, I don't know, and perhaps you've done some research on how this has been working with the Hawks. They have the same situation. As I recall, when that legislation went through, they have a judge to go to. I'm hoping you can give us some feedback on whether or not that's been working under the current situation, when in fact where we have perhaps police members going to this judge, even though there is this culture of silence, protection of fellow SAPS members. I have always had the feeling from various input I've had that actually going to that judge is a career-limiting move, and that actually members are penalised if they go and tell tales, as it were, about their fellow SAPS members. So could you give us some input on how it's working currently and what, you know, for us to decide whether or not it has any merit at all? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presenters. You are saying somewhere in your document here that if members feel that this is illegal instruction, they can just refuse that. I just want to check with you whether these members are adequately trained to take such decisions. Thanks.
Just maybe a follow-up as well. The Honourable Kula's Barnard's question now actually jogs my mind in terms of this. Can we get an indication, if possible, I know the head of rules are here, to what extent there was a need to use the retired judge under the current legislation so that we can actually see, and to what effect it was used?
Over to your researchers. If you have difficulty in answering any question, feel free to say so. We will actually refer that question to the relevant people that are here.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. I'll try to answer the question as best I can, and then just hand over to people more qualified maybe to give a legal or an expert opinion on the whole. I'll start with Honourable Logan. He asked that the undermining of the independence of the Ministerial Committee. The section was specifically taken out of the previous law because it was feared that a committee made up of the executive, of political executive, will have undue interference in the policy determinations of the whole. So that was taken out. They did feel that it is undermining the independence of the directorate, whereas now the placing the authority to most of the power given previously to the Ministerial Committee to the Minister of Police safeguards largely against political interference, as this committee can actually hold the Minister accountable for actions or policy guidelines drafted by himself.
Chair, if I may. Chair. I beg your pardon. I have some other questions. I do not believe the researchers have the ability to answer. May we put them with the view to getting answers from other people on the other side of the house, or shall we wait until a later stage? Could you just fill me in on how this is going to work, please?
I think we will focus on what the researchers have presented, and then we will then take presentations from organizations that are here. We can ask questions directed to them, but sometimes they can actually need somebody from the department to give clarity to the question per se, maybe because somebody is raising an issue which you want clarity on, but probably the department would be better placed to respond to that. Yes. Nicolette?
Thank you, Chair. Honourable member, the ministerial committee is still contained in the bill in front of us today. However, most of the power previously given to the ministerial committee is now limited, and the ministerial committee actually just plays a coordinating role at present as contained in the bill. So it should be clarified further why the structure was actually still contained or is still present in the bill, as they don't have a real, you know, function except for coordination. If that clarifies the question. And then your question regarding the whether the exclusion of the Minister of Parliament and Ministerial Committee will provide independence.
I think what a lot of the submissions are saying, and again it's also related to the issue of the Ministerial Committee, is the Ministerial Committee does, I think, decrease the independence just in terms of the accountability and stuff. The fact that Nicolette and some of the other submissions have said a committee is very difficult to hold accountable, individual ministers. So in our opinion as the research unit, accountability to an individual minister versus accountability to a ministerial committee is a different thing, because there's more control over one minister than a group of ministers. I don't think Parliament is related to independence. I think everybody would argue that the more parliamentary control there is over any body, so it's not about removing the power of Parliament. I think it's the opposite. It's about increasing the powers of Parliament, possibly decreasing the political control through the ministerial committee and or the minister. But like I say, I think in our opinion, making a minister accountable rather than a group of ministers having that kind of role is preferable. But that's just our opinion.
Thanks. Honourable Rahmat Likhani, you asked regarding the submissions we received. Of the 21 submissions we received, 11 of the 10 was substantial. The other 11 was, all the 21 save one submission was opposed to the bill, but they said that their bill is inconsistent with the Glenister judgment. There was only one submission received that was stating that the bill suffices the requirements of the constitutional judgment. Then most of the submissions, not most, but many of the submissions does indicate towards or speak to a Chapter 9 institution to be created, or that elements from Chapter 9 institutions like appointments and so forth be contained in the bill. And this is largely, you know, the Chapter 9 institutions, if like the NPA and the Electoral Commission, which is only governed, it's not governed by a, you know, it's like, I may that answers your question, but Chapter 9 institutions really operate quite differently towards any other institution. And many submissions did indicate that it should be considered as a possible provision for the establishment of the hall. Then also, Honourable Khani asked regarding the reference made to the National Commissioner. Reference is made to the National Commissioner unless
in the amendment bill than the previous bill. And this was just to facilitate the head of the directorate with more responsibility over the directorate. However, concerns are raised that excluding the National Commissioner from identifying priority crimes, for example, is not consistent with the Constitution in Section 207, and thus, you know, in basically excluding the National Commissioner, it could be argued that it is inconsistent with the Constitution.
Chair, follow up on that one, if I may, Chair. I want to know what research you've done about this business of the National Police Commissioner. And I've got two words to say here, Jackie Celebi. Now, had the scorpion fallen under Jackie Celebi, the then National Police Commissioner, he wouldn't be languishing in a five-star hospital bed today. He would still be the National Police Commissioner because that investigation would have been shut down. So have you looked at other entities, other independent entities? I mean, do they answer to someone who is then not someone they can investigate? Does that person have control over their finances? I see he or she will also, of course, be controlling the funds. That gives them absolute control over what they do. I don't see any independence in this at all. Have you looked at other models where this person is left out? Because it's just an impossibility.
Thank you, Honourable Kolobana. Where I have not, it's very difficult to actually identify institutions where this is done before, because it is a quite unique situation. But this is to just to go to also Honourable from my question. It is, we have looked at international models of anti-corruption agencies, and South African model does conform to international standards. It's very difficult because in the research it showed that there is no standardized model and there is no set criteria for these agencies, which makes it very difficult to actually establish them. But our research indicates that we have a very it conforms to the law enforcement agencies, departments and all units established in international community. These models are very commonly used, and it is the most dominant model found in Western Europe. Sorry. And so we have looked extensively, did a literature study on international agencies, and it is clear that the bill did try to look at certain aspects of these international anti-corruption agencies. And sorry, Honourable Ramachakani, you also asked regarding the budget consultation, whether after or in consultation, the arguments brought forward and the concerns raised when the National Commissioner drafted the budget after consultation with the head of the DPCI is that it will actually allow the National Commissioner to ignore the recommendations made by the head of the DPCI as to where funds must be allocated. But that is not the worst-case scenario. I mean, but that is what could happen. That is why a lot of analysts also state that it should be done in consultation, but it is not clear whether this will be in line with the CMFA. So it must just be cleared out whether, you know, this can be done in consultation with the aid, which will be arguably better. I'm sorry, Honourable Van Dijk asked a question regarding the reference made to the independence of the submission. Most of the submissions is not opposed to the bill. They just feel that the bill has a very minimalist approach to the genus adjustment and the requirements set out by the adjustment. In saying that they only addressed the broad considerations and did not really look in focus on really addressing all the issues. They just, it is argued that the bill only addresses the major concern raised by the Constitutional Court. I quickly want to go to Honourable Khedu. The illegal instruction, it should be cleared up whether police members are properly trained how to do that. I can see that it could be a concern that it could be difficult to disobey an order from a superior officer. But it is a safeguard that is available to the members should they feel extreme coercion or intimidation from the top. So it could be argued that it is good in theory and policy, but maybe not that easy in practical terms. So I think that needs to be further clarified. Sorry, Honourable Scholar Barnard. The retired judge, the inclusion of the retired judge was met with much criticism, as it is seen that it is not the safeguard that it was meant to be, in that it is largely a reactive safeguard rather than to actually protect members from interference, and that is actually what is needed, that members should be protected from interference before it happens. But I think maybe the Secretariat or the Department can further elaborate on that.
May I just ask our researchers if, in light of the Constitutional Court, all right, telling us and telling us basically what we know, that as a state we're signatories to international protocols, which say we must have an independent unit. And in light of the fact that we were told when the Hawks Bill was initially put through that the Hawks would be independent, and the Constitutional Court now says it's not, did you at any stage look in your research at the possibility of setting up a truly independent unit, something not falling under SAP, perhaps falling under another ministry, back under justice, elsewhere that SAP's rank structure won't be brought to bear on its members? I mean, that is the crux of the entire matter. And when you talk about going to a judge, SAP's members will destroy their careers if they do. You say they don't have to listen to an order that is illegal or something they don't agree. They won't. it's a rent structure. They are taught from day one to do what their superior officers tell them. So have you looked at an alternative to what we've got here? Or have you simply worked on what is being presented before us here today? Because there are, in the submissions, many requests for alternatives to what is being suggested, to something falling under the National Police Commissioner. So I want to know if you've done that kind of research, if we've looked at the international best practice and said, actually, it's done better here, it's done better there, in a manner that does not fall under the head of a ranked structure. Because that's got to be the absolute crux of the entire matter, surely. Thank you.
Honourable Member, we have indeed looked at international best practice, but it is very difficult to point towards best practice because international standards do not exist. However, in the research we have done, it was clear that the South African model does conform to acceptable models in the international arena, and it is the most dominated model in Western Europe. So the specifications as set forward by international models, although it's not a set criteria, there are identified links or guidelines, if you will, to basically put these different models into functional spheres. And having an anti-corruption agency within either a law enforcement unit or a prosecuting authority is internationally acceptable, and it is widely done.
There seem not to be any other hand, and if Honourable Ramatlakane.
Yeah, thanks, Honourable Chair. Maybe I should paraphrase my other question, which I think is not answered sufficiently. I was asking, in relation to the work that the research has been able to do, including also looking at the judgment itself, with respect to the National Commissioner and the role of the director of this special unit, which means the head of this unit, the issue of the accountability, and how is the independency perceived to be. Already the issue about the rank structure, you can see the rank structure, but what I'm asking the question is the question of independence in terms of the work that you've been able to do separated from that of accounting to the subordinating that unit to the National Commissioner? What type of information comes out of that work in terms of how is that perceived and how is it being argued, including the judgment itself? Because I think the crux of this issue is if you have the senior junior in terms of the structure, you're starting already with a wobble. So that's why I'm trying to establish your work that you've been able to do, if you understand what I'm saying. That's really the question I'm asking in relation to the both the submission that you've received in terms of what you have been able to peruse through, as well as what has already been decided in terms of the judgment insofar as the weaknesses of that independence is concerned.
Really well. But my understanding of it was that the issue is limitations on the role and the interference of the National Commissioner. I don't think the judgment said, in my opinion, the judgment didn't say that the DCI cannot do it in the SAPs. If it would have said that, then clearly the National Commission is totally problematic in its entirety. But it didn't say that. It pointed to very specific areas which were problematic in terms of independence. So my reading of that, again, not as a lawyer, not as an expert, and not even as someone who's read the judgment with a microscope, is that it means you have to work with that. You can work with that. Not that you have to. You can work within the fact that there is a national commissioner, and what is that relationship between the national commissioner and the head of the directorate. And I think that the bill has tried to do that. So it's tried to limit some of the scope of accountability that the National Commissioner has, and to increase the scope of power of the head. The question that Parliament and the committee have to deal with is whether that is sufficient. And I think that there's a lot that can probably be done to ensure that that is increased even more, to ensure that the head of the directorate would really fulfill and be as independent as possible, even if it is within the scope of being within the SACs and then obviously in a rank structure and under the control of the National Commissioner. But there's a lot to do, and the issue I think you raised also around budget is the one area to look at. Even though, and I agree with Nicolette, I think we need to really look at whether the National Commissioner as accounting officer in the police is in control of the budget. That's a, you keep the accounting officer. So you have to work within those parameters, and there may be ways of looking at it where you can ensure that the budget that the head of the directorate proposes or needs for his unit actually does get taken to Treasury in that form. So, but the committee, I think, is going to need to be innovative and creative and to look within the parameters of that about how to increase those kind of powers of the head and of the unit.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Nadia, and thank you very much, Nicolette. I think you've presented quite quality research work, and it's assisting us with the Portfolio Committee. Let me again encourage members of the Portfolio Committee to read the judgment, because it will be important for all of us as we process this bill to have read the judgment. Otherwise, we probably might not be that prepared to process this bill. I just want to, seeing that we still have got some time, I just want to remind members that the basis for appeal, according to the judgment by Mr. Glenister, was that in enacting the Hawkes Amendment Act, the legislature, which was Parliament or is Parliament, violated a number of its constitutional obligations. And he contended that those obligations were to act reasonably and accountably, to cultivate good human resource management, to respect international treaty obligations, to maintain an independent anti-corruption unit, to allow public participation in the legislative process, to allow the MPA properly to exercise its functions, and to respect values enshrined in the Bill of Rights. And in granting leave to appeal, the Constitutional Court raised the following questions or issues, which I think it's important for us to note, referring to the amendments and referred to as impugned laws. The Constitutional Court asked as to whether they are irrational. If they do they run afoul of constitutional provisions dealing with the powers and functions of the NPA? Does the Constitution require Parliament to establish an independent anti-corruption unit? And if so, did Parliament comply? Do the impugned laws otherwise infringe any of the rights in the Bill of Rights? And in the event of application succeeding on any of these grounds, what is the appropriate relief? These are the questions that the judgment responded to. And I just want to go to one issue which is quite interesting to me. The judgment takes time to define independence. it defines it according to Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is, of course, an international organization helping government to tackle the economic, social, and governance challenges. Mm-hmm. And the judgment refers to this definition. It says anti-corruption. In fact, it says independence primarily means anti-corruption bodies should be shielded from undue political interference, political will to fight corruption, a comprehensive anti-corruption strategy, varying level of independence according to specific needs and conditions, structural and operational autonomy that is important along with a clear legal basis and mandate, transparent procedures for appointment and removal of the director with proper resource management and internal controls are important elements to prevent undue interference. The judge or judgment further states that the OECD, which is that an Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development report, found that one of the mandatory features of specialized institutions is not full independence, but rather an adequate level of structural and operational autonomy secured through institutional and legal mechanisms aimed at preventing undue political interference as well as promoting preemptive obedience. And therefore, according to the judgment, also independence entails depoliticization of anti-corruption institutions and the type and mandate of anti-corruption institutions. And the question, therefore, is whether does the structure and form given to the entity ensure it is sufficiently independent? I think this is the question as we proceed with this bill we'll have to answer properly as the portfolio committee. I'm just referring to this, but I'm really here requesting members to read the judgment. It is interesting, and it is important to read the judgment. There are two, like I'm saying, it was a split decision, 5-4. It's very interesting to read these two, particularly if you are a person like myself, because you say it's possible that judges can interpret the Constitution and refer to the section so differently, but of course it's quite interesting read. I had time to go through these, and it's quite interesting when you read them. But I think these are the questions that, as we proceed processing this bill, we'll have from time to time to ask, is the structure and form we are giving to this entity ensure it's sufficient independence? I think that will be important as we proceed processing this bill. Members, time now is 11. Our first presentation is at 11:45, but I think we can just take a 30-minute break. We'll then come back here, because I think people who will be presenting are already here in the house. So just 30-minute break, they still want to leave, and then we'll come back here. Thank you very much. And let me... Let me first appreciate the fact that you've made these submissions and showed interest to come and make oral submissions. And I think most of the organizations that are here on a continuous basis show interest in the work of the police and as such the work of this portfolio committee. And we always appreciate that. Almost all submissions that we've gone through, they are important issues that they are raising and important suggestions that they are putting forward, which I think this portfolio committee will take into consideration as and when it is deliberating on the bill that is starting from next week. And therefore, I want to really take this opportunity to welcome and to appreciate the very interest that you have in the work of the portfolio committee, particularly on police. Probably you have interest on other portfolio committees or work related to security, but I think you've shown some interest in our work. We request for information to share with information with us on a number of issues, and you've always been there to assist us. And we can say here today that we are a phone call away from yourself. We are interested to know the research that you're conducting related to the work of police. If there is anything that you are busy doing that has impact on the work of the police, we'll always try to find time, if you indicate, to want to come and share such scientific work with the police, with the portfolio committee. I will now allow Professor Pierre DeVos to, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correct, to take us through the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Always nice to come to Parliament, especially because I can wear my suit that I was forced to buy by the late Cardinal Asmal, because he said I cannot work for you if I don't wear a suit. So I'm very happy to come here, and then I at least don't waste my money. And also to hopefully, in my small way, to assist the committee and Parliament to draft legislation in the end that's going to stand the test of time and the Constitutional Court judgment. Now, I will start off by saying I think the drafters of this bill have set itself a very difficult task, because it needs to comply with the Constitutional Court judgment, the majority judgment in the Glenister case, to which it is bound, and Parliament is now bound. But at the same time, it's trying to, within the confines of the Public Finance Management Act, which sets the head of the police force, police commissioner, as the accounting officer and so forth, within that structure to create an independent or sufficiently independent unit within the existing police force. And I think that is not an easy task, and I want to say that whatever the outcome is, it's going to be difficult to achieve. What I thought I'll do is, as my expertise is very much in constitutional law, to focus very strongly on my interpretation of the majority judgment in the Glenister case and what it actually means and what it actually says and what it doesn't say, and then just to highlight a few of the issues relating to the draft bill. In my written submissions, obviously, I make far more detailed provisions. Now, the first thing I want to point out is that the Glenister judgment did not find that Section 179 of the Constitution obliges Parliament to locate a specialized corruption fighting unit within the National Prosecuting Authority, as was the case with the Scorpion. There was no finding that there had to be a move back to the Scorpion. We are all agreed on that. So it was also found that the creation of a separate corruption fighting unit within the South African Police Services structure was not in and by itself constitutionally problematic, although the judgment is a little bit vague about how that will actually have to happen. And the judgment also did not ask or answer the question of how an independent corruption fighting body in the police can operate given the constraints of the Public Finance Management Act, which makes the police commissioner the head of the police force and responsible for the police force. What it did find is that the Constitution imposes a positive obligation on the state and therefore on Parliament to pass legislation to create a sufficiently independent corruption fighting body. And I think here I want to just pause and say the interesting thing for me, perhaps as a constitutional lawyer, is that the Constitutional Court said this was necessary not only because of the international obligations that South Africa faces, but also because corruption is something that affects the ability of the state to deliver on social economic rights promises. If there is endemic corruption in the state, then the very people who are most in need of having access to housing, healthcare, and so on are the ones who are going to suffer most. And I think for me that is the important thing, and that is why I feel passionate about the notion of having an independent corruption fighting unit. So what I want to do now is say in more detail what I, in my interpretation, is of the Glenister judgment, what it actually entails. And To understand the judgment, I think it's important to understand that it works on two levels, the majority judgment. First, the judgment sets out general criteria or principles that must be met by anybody, any institution or body, corruption-fighting body, that is going to be sufficiently independent. And once the judgment set out those general criteria, it then went on to look at the legislation that was passed that creates the hawks and found them wanting in very specific cases. And I think it is helpful to look at these two issues together, not to only look at those aspects of the judgment which specifically found provisions of the Police Services Act unconstitutional, but also to look at the broader constitutional requirements of what independence might actually entail, because they are interrelated with one another. So on the general principle, the court said that, or the majority at least, that said that the Constitution as a whole in its scheme requires the state to set up a concrete and effective mechanism to prevent and root out corruption and cognate corrupt practices. And then went on to say why corruption is a big problem in our society. And at the heart of the inquiry, said the court, is whether the body will be free from political influence and interference. So it's political influence and interference, not the one or the other, which is not so easy to achieve. So that it can do its job effectively, on the one hand, while of course remaining financially and politically accountable, on the other hand. And there's a distinction between accountability and the control or oversight by the political institutions. And as the Honourable Chairperson noted, the court also emphasized the need to depoliticize the anti-corruption fighting institution, because of course where such an institution is politicized, then whenever decision is taken either to prosecute or to investigate or not to investigate somebody, there's always suspicions that this might be done for political reasons, as our recent history so clearly shows. To achieve this, a body need not attain the kind of independence set the court of, for example, the judiciary. So you don't have to have exactly the same extreme form of independence that the judiciary is protected by in the Constitution. But what is required is still a protection from being exposed to undue political influence. And so there must be legal mechanisms established in this legislation that will limit the possibility of an abuse of the chain of command if the body is going to be within the police force, for example, so that interference in the operational decisions about starting, continuing, and ending criminal investigations will not be possible, and there won't be even a possibility for any political powerful person to make such interference there. So at the heart of the matter is the operational independence, so that the body itself can decide exactly who, when to start a investigation, when to continue a investigation, and when, of course, to end a criminal investigation in a specific case. And then the court said for this, just like with a court, but to slightly lesser degree, there are two aspects that are important: the structural independence and the operational independence. Structural independence relates to the appointment of members and the conditions under which members operate and its funding, which must all be regulated in such a manner as to ensure the independence are in fact there, and also, as I will show later, that it is perceived to be independent by the public. So to prevent undue political intervention, the proper appointment and recruitment mechanisms is necessary that would guarantee the designation of persons that are of a sufficiently high professional quality and integrity, and the conditions of service that pertain to its members and also especially its head, but not only to its head, is pivotal to insulate the body from political interference. This kind of independence is assessed on the basis of factors such as security of tenure, remuneration, and mechanisms for accountability and oversight. Because the court kept on saying there must be accountability, which is not the same thing as operational responsibility to political head. Which brings me to the operational independence. And the court said this relates to the body's relationship with the legislature and the executive, oversight over the body and accountability to the two political branches of government. Where the body is placed within an existing police structure, and as said the Constitutional Court, very special care must be taken to safeguard its operational independence. And it quotes there from the OECD document, which says that in such a system where the body is placed within the existing police force with its hierarchy, the system, there will be risks of undue influence, and they will be substantially higher when an individual investigator or prosecutor lacks autonomous decision-making power. And there will be a possibility that must be guarded against, that there will be an abuse of the chain of command and the hierarchical structure, because police forces are by their very nature hierarchical in nature. And now in our system it's even more clear because we went back to the military ranking system. And so they quote also further from this document saying, for instance, special anti-corruption departments or units within a police or prosecution service can be subject to separate hierarchical rules and appointments procedure. Police officers working on corruption cases though institutionally placed within the police, should in individual cases report only and directly to the competent prosecutor. Now, the court then went on to admit that there are a very big range of measures that can be taken. And as the Honourable Chairperson pointed out, the requirement is that those measures must be reasonable, given these requirements of independence that I set out now. The reasonability is, reasonability standard must be a standard that is applied in a context, and the context is the one of institutional and operational independence. And then lastly, as I said, the court went further by saying that for this general principle, it is important to note that independence is not only about what actually is written in the document or what actually happens on the ground. It is also about the appearance or perception of independence. It is important that a body that is created is structured in such a way that a reasonable person, and our courts have said a reasonable person is not those people who phone in from Fishhook and complain or Cape Talk about everything. It is a person who actually is informed about what's going on in the world, that is not overtly suspicious, but is a person who can reasonably look at the situation, that such a person must believe that that body is free from political influence and political interference. And that is very important, I think, in the discussion here, and that's why I say this is such a difficult task that the drafters of this amendment have set themselves, because given what has happened in the police force and all these allegations swirling around us, there's going to be a difficulty in this regard, it seems to me. The specific requirements for independence relating to the existence of the Hawks, the Constitutional Court then went on to talk about, and the Constitutional Court then says that the thrust of the reasoning why the Hawks was not, as it's currently structured, was not independent, was that it was not sufficiently insulated from political influence and potential interference, which is not the same as actual interference. We are not saying that a politician will interfere, but if there's a potential that such a politician will interfere, that is a problem. There were primarily two reasons advanced for this conclusion. First, there is an absence of security of tenure protecting the employment of the head, but also other members of the Hawks, and hence its conditions of service were flawed. Second, it found that the structure and functioning of the Hawks allowed for direct political oversight of the entity functioning in a manner incompatible with its independence. So on the security of tenure, the problem was seen on different levels. Firstly, the head of the Hawks is appointed by the police, the political head of the police, the minister of police. And the other persons are appointed to the DPCI currently on a different basis. And in addition to the head, the directorate currently comprises persons appointed by the National Commissioner of the SAPS on recommendation of the head. The minister is required to report to Parliament on the appointment in the current system. Now, what the court said is that the commissioner is empowered to discharge a member of the service for reasons other than objective criteria, like unfitness or incapacity. And as long as, at the moment, as long as the discharge will promote efficiency of economy in the SAPS or will otherwise be in the interest of the SAPS, I'm quoting from the legislation, the reach of the dismissal is acceptable. The reach of the provisions appear to include, said the court, noted the court, also the head of the directorate. And so the court said that there was a problem with the independence of both the head of the directorate and all other members of the directorate who did not have that security of tenure. They could be appointed by the politician, and they could also be fired by somebody like the head of the police force, the police service, as the constitution would call it, who is a political appointee whose term of office can be extended for another term, and who therefore could be perceived not to be politically independent. So that was a big concern for the Constitutional Court. The majority judgment did not make a finding on this, although it suggested that the current arrangement in Section 179 of the Constitution regarding the National Prosecuting Authority Act would be a suitable one for the head of the Corruption Fighting Unit. So an equation between the head of the National Prosecuting Authority and the National Prosecuting Authority generally and the minister, the kind of relationship that is established there might be appropriate. The court didn't find that it need to be that way, but it said that is not a bad mechanism to use, because in terms of Section 179, the head of the prosecuting authority is required to act without fear or favor or prejudice, is therefore found by the Constitutional Court to be independent and to require to act independently, but must, if requested by the minister, must give the minister information about any investigations or prosecutions that is going to happen. The minister, however, said the Supreme Court of Appeal, can then not interfere and say, well, a prosecution cannot continue or a prosecution should continue. And that way the minister takes responsibility, the minister can be kept informed, but at the same time the minister cannot make a specific interference in there. If that were to happen, as Frenin Chinwala pointed out in her Commission of Inquiry report, that would be a criminal offence in terms of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. So this is a model that I think one can keep in the back of one's head. Further, the court said institutional safeguards require statutory secured remuneration levels, something that in the at present with the present Hawks legislation is not the case. Then the third issue is the insulation from political interference and influence versus accountability that I want to talk about a bit more. The Constitution obviously requires that a member of the Cabinet must be responsible for policing, and that is also something that is thrown into the mix that makes the task of the drafters of this legislation, I think, a little bit more difficult. But as I said, if we follow the NPA model, maybe it can be addressed. This requirement must be squared with the requirement that policing body responsible for corruption should be free from any actual and potential political influence or interference. The majority in the Glemmis judgment emphasized that this constitutional injunction does not actually require that the anti-corruption fighting body must itself function under police oversight or under the oversight of the Minister of Police. To this end, the particular political oversight arrangement in the impugned legislation was found to be incompatible with the adequate independence, the ministerial committee and the minister's powers over the Hawks were found to be incompatible with independence. However, adequate independence does not require insulation from political accountability, and that is the point I'm trying to make all the time, that there's a difference between accountability and a kind of oversight that could allow anybody in the executive to direct either implicitly or explicitly what kind of cases should be investigated or should not be investigated. Accountability is that the body makes decisions operationally about what cases to take on, what cases to pursue, what cases not to take on, but that it is accountable in the sense that it has to respond and report to the political heads about what is happening. And that is the distinction, it seems to me, that is very important that the majority in the Constitutional Court judgment makes. Now, given these general principles, there are certain specific problems that the court found with the Hawks legislation. And one of them was the policy, the issue of issuing policy guidelines. And the ministerial committee, which is a committee of cabinet members, and the constitutional court said where there is this oversight mechanism of a ministerial committee who could set policy guidelines for which crimes could be investigated, which ones could not be investigated, this will raise constitutional problems. Coordination can be direct, said the court, or it can be indirect. Direct coordination will occur where a member of cabinet can influence the selection of the crimes to be investigated by the unit. But there's also indirect coordination, which is also a problem, and that will occur where a member of the cabinet can issue policy guidelines in respect of the functioning of the unit, as well as for the selection of national priority offences. Both issues were found to be problematic by the majority judgment. So section 17D1 small a determined that the DPCI could investigate priority crimes which in the opinion of the DPCI needs to be investigated, but this was subject to policy guidelines by the ministerial committee, and the constitutional court found that those policy guidelines could be problematic because the policy guidelines could be completely above board, and they might very well be above board, but they can also be used in the wrong hands, and that we, the court in this case seemed to suggest that one, when it comes to corruption, one must legislate not for who one thinks, what one thinks the politicians might do, but what one might fear the politicians might one day do when one is not in charge. So, that is, for me, important. That is why the ministerial committee and the guidelines that they could set up was problematic. Secondly, in terms of section 17D1B, the National Police Commissioner can also refer matters to the DPCI for investigation. And this raised the same concern as above, that there could be indirect interference by the head of the police service. The occurrence of this interference could be in two ways, said the court. First, the head of the DPCI as National Deputy National Commissioner and as a member of the SSPS currently is accountable to the National Commissioner. And that is what's so difficult, because if you're going to have this unit within the police, then it's very difficult to imagine how the deputy head is not going to be accountable to the commissioner. But if he is, the commissioner's post lacks political sufficient security of tenure, thus inevitably creating a vulnerability to political pressure. So that is an indirect way of potential interference, where the head of the police, to whom the head of the Hawks must respond, he or she might not be politically free from influence and might then place indirectly or directly, but indirectly from the political head, pressure on the head of the Hawks. Second, said the Constitutional Court, in terms of Section 1712A and D, a ministerial committee is allowed to issue these policy guidelines, which I already referred to before. And here it is important to note that the Constitutional Court said there was nothing in the statute that actually required the policy guidelines to be broad and harmless. So if there is going to be anything in the legislation dealing with policy guidelines, then there will have to be something in there to guide the discretion in the draft bill. The discretion is given to the minister, but then that discretion needs to be guided so that it is clear what kind of policy guidelines can be given and what kind of policy guidelines cannot be given. Because in the wrong hands, the guidelines could be used to limit the powers of the corruption fighting unit actually to fight the corruption. The judgment goes, and I think in that sense the draft legislation to some extent addresses this, but the judgment has a lot to say about the powers of the ministerial committee and the potential for that ministerial committee to have hands-on supervision over the Hawks, because they must meet regularly in the current legislation, and the ministry, they must be provided with information, and they can issue these guidelines, which is all found to be problematic. Those are in, I see I'm now taking a lot of time, but I'll take 5 or 10 more minutes just to say, those were the concerns raised by the Constitutional Court. Now, I have set out in my written submission all the possible problems that I foresee with the draft legislation, but I'll highlight just a few here that I think are particularly important. The first one is about the security of tenure, the appointment and the security of tenure of the head of the unit and also of the other members of the unit. So for me that is pivotal, and I think that is clear from the Constitutional Court case, that the appointment of the head of the unit is problematic, because at the moment it is done by the in the proposal it is supposed to be done by the minister, but there are no criteria set down for what the qualities must be of the person appointed. So apart from the fact that there's that it's a political appointment in the sense that the head of the cabinet member responsible for police appoints, there are no criteria that will guide that person, like with the head of the National Prosecuting Authority, where it says the person must be fit and proper and so forth and so forth. Seems to me a problem. I would think that a better model would be for a different kind of appointment mechanism. This might be controversial, but I would think something like the mechanism used for the appointment of the Independent Electoral Commissioner, where a body of eminent persons, the Chief Justice, the head of the Human Rights Commission and so on, appoint such a person based on certain guidelines. That would be, for me, prize A, probably not required by the Constitutional Court judgment. At least I would say by the Constitutional Court judgment, what would be required is that there would be clear, objective criteria set out for the appointment of this person. Secondly, the security of tenure of both the head of the Hawks and other members of the Hawks is not sufficiently protected, it seems to me. This is so for various reasons in the given the proposals. The first one is that the proposals say that the head of the unit can be appointed for a fixed period, which is a huge improvement on the present situation. It says for a 7-year term, but it could also be less than 7 years. I'm not sure why that is. It seems to me it would be very helpful to have actually a really fixed term there, so that there could not be political discretion to appoint somebody for 4 years, and after which that person will need a job. And then he might or she might need a job within the police service. And that might create a situation where somebody is going to be a little bit nervous to upset anybody that might give them a job in the police service. Secondly, the firing of the head of the national, of the Hawks, there are some problems with it seems to me. Improvement is that there are now criteria for when the head of the Hawks can be fired in the proposals, but one of those criteria seems to me not to be actually objective. The other criteria are, a person may be removed for misconduct on account of ill health, on account of not being a fit and proper person. Those criteria are more or less in legal terms objective. But another criterion is suggested, and that is that a person can be removed on account of incapacity to carry out his or her duties efficiently. Now, whether one fulfills one's duties efficiently is always going to be a matter of opinion. Maybe my dean thinks I'm not fulfilling my duties efficiently because I'm not at the office today on the year. I would think that I am. So there's always going to be, that's really an opening there for using this criteria to fire somebody for political reasons. Secondly, there had to be an inquiry, but there are no criteria for how the inquiry should happen, as is the case in the National Prosecuting Authority Act. So it doesn't say who should chair this inquiry. It could be the minister who decides him or herself to inquire about the fitness or not. And it seems to me that is also a problem. As is the case in the National Prosecuting Authority Act, which I think is a problem, when a person is suspended pending an inquiry, then that person can be suspended without pay. Now, I know many taxpayers like this kind of provision, but it can be used as an intimidating tool for somebody that might not have another income. Lastly, the draft provisions also say that the two Houses of Parliament can remove the head of the directorate by praying for such removal on any of the grounds referred to above. But it doesn't say there has to be an investigation so that they can be objectively established whether one of those criteria have been met. And why this section for me doesn't really meet the requirements of independence, apart from the facts that I set out already, is if you look at that section that has now been inserted, section 17B, capital D, capital A. And that section says that the section deals with a loss of confidence in the head of the directorate. Now, it seems to me this is a bit of a Freudian slip, because a loss of confidence is a subjective standard. If I lose confidence in somebody, it might be because they're not doing what I want them to do, and that is not sufficiently independent. So especially given that one criteria that says it's about whether you're fulfilling your task efficiently, it seems that there might be problems with this. Then, regarding ordinary members, I think there's also a problem. And that is that the draft legislation has now inserted a new section, which says, section 17N, which says, subject to the provisions of this Act, members of the directorate are members of the South African Police Service, all the powers, duties, and functions of other members of the South African Police Service. So they're subject to the police discipline. So ordinary members of the Hawks do not have the security of tenure, even the limited amount of security of tenure proposed in the legislation for the head of the directorate. So they can be removed for completely non-objective grounds or moved sideways or whatever the case might be. So if you're an individual investigator and you happen to investigate something that is politically sensitive, maybe you are investigating a Brett Kebble kind of person, and now there's going to be perhaps political pressure on you to not investigate properly. Because if you are, then the fear might be instilled in you, or it might be suggested by somebody, rightly or wrongly. It might not be a fear that could actually be acted upon, but there will be a fear that you are actually going to be removed from your position in the Hawks. And given the fact that this unit has a special status, and that the kind of work that is done there is of a specific importance in our constitutional democracy, nobody would want to be removed and to become investigating ordinary garden variety crimes. Not that any crimes are garden variety, but okay. So I feel that is also a problem. Then, about the ministerial committee and oversight, I think that the legislation goes some way to addressing that by, as was noted by the researchers, by basically taking away, or it seems, taking away all the ministerial committee's power, which was one of the problems in set out by the Constitutional Court with the legislation. However, there is still, by the back door, a potential power for the ministerial committee, because Section 17J2B, which talks about the operational operational committee, which is a committee made up, yes, of the head of the Hawks, but also the head of police force, and such other persons as the operational committee may require, and so forth. So there is still people in there that, according to the Constitutional Court, not me, but according to the Constitutional Court, are not potentially politically independent. And they have the power to instruct the ministerial committee to perform such functions as from time to time. The operational committee can be instructed by the ministerial committee, to perform such functions as from time to time may be directed to them by the ministerial committee. This is very open-ended. So the ministerial committee, in the other section, their powers have been curtailed, but in this section, which has not been amended, section 17J2B, they have the power to instruct the operational committee to do what they are required to do. So it's sort of an indirect way in which potentially the ministerial committee could once again reassert its political influence over the day-to-day operation of this unit. And as we remember, one of the things that the Constitutional Court said is what is the heart of this whole thing is that this institution must be able to decide who to prosecute, who to begin to investigate, who to proceed with the investigation with, and also if they feel there is no case, when to drop a case. And that is going to be very difficult in fact, and also in terms of the perceptions that I spoke about, if there's this backdoor possibility for the ministerial committee to give instructions on this particular matter. Then on the protection of those members of the Hawks, the Constitutional Court said that one of the problems with protection was that that there was this retired judge that was given the power to investigate the matter, and then the retired judge would be able ex post facto to hear complaints by members of the Hawks. And they said this was not proactive enough, the Constitutional Court. They had to, because often the horse would have bolted long before the stable door had been closed. If you can only complain to this retired judge after there has been attempts at political interference. We assume for the moment that those hawks are going to be very brave and they are going to resist the political interference, but maybe they won't, or there might be in other kind of involvement. And this is not addressed by the draft. The draft does not actually in any way deal or provide for a proactive mechanism to protect this unit from possible interference and to safeguard them so that they know that if there's going to be potential political influence, which if you read about corruption anywhere in the world, whether it is in the United States or in Kenya or in South Africa, wherever, there's always going to be the temptation for a little bit of political pressure there. And the idea is that this body will then be, should really be created to protect people so that they feel that they have, in a way, cover, legal cover, political cover, to do their job without fearing that they might somehow be victimized. So I have many other provisions there that I think might be potentially problematic, but I don't want to bore you to death with all of them. You can go and read, the honourable members can read my submission. I just want to make one additional submission in this regard. And I understand that this is a very difficult situation. If you're going to have the body within the police force, I find it very difficult to know how we're going to manage to get such a body to be both independent yet accountable to the police commissioner. That is going to be very difficult. But in any case, one additional provision that could be inserted in this act to help create also the perception that there will not be political interference or influence is the kind of provision that one finds once again in the National Prosecuting Authority Act, which is an act that I am quoting from here quite a lot, which says that it is a criminal offence to interfere with the prosecuting authority and the decisions of the prosecuting authority. So a provision that is phrased in such a way that says that it will be a criminal offence for anyone to try and influence the members of the Hawks and especially its head to begin an investigation, to continue an investigation, or to cease an investigation. That will go, I think, some way to allay some of the perception fears that come in, because it will really then expose those in both the private institutions and in the political realm who might be enticed to think that they can put some pressure on the unit to either prosecute somebody or investigate somebody because it's a political opponent, or to stop an investigation because it happens to be a political ally. So I think that is something to be taken into account, but I think I'll leave it there and leave it open to the committee if there are any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Tifos. Quite interesting to listen to your presentation. If I was still young, I would apply to be in your class. The age has caught up with me, so you'll have a problem to teach a student. But thank you very much for the presentation. I will allow members to ask questions from this presentation. Honorable Angie, Honorable Annelies, Honorable Ramatlakane, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the presentation. My question is, my first question is on the security of them. What do you think about the security of Kenya? Is it adequately addressed in line with the judgment? And if it's not, can you make some suggestions to that effect? My second question is on about the two houses of parliament that can remove the head of the directorate without any inquiry. What are your suggestions in this regard? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Professor DeVos. A couple of questions. First one would be, I think it was to some extent covered by the member, Bolabatsi, already, but how do we improve the tenure of ordinary members? What is your suggestions in terms of the improvement of tenure of ordinary members? You know, you said at some point the committee will have to be creative, and I agree with you on that. And, you know, I would just like to hear from you in terms of how do you think it can be done? Should we look at, for instance, the possibility of saying that a person can only be removed from the service? If so, after due process, suggested by the head of the walks, obviously it's always going to be the National Commissioner that administratively does that. But is it what I'm hearing from you is we need to build in other checks and balances in terms of that? So if you can just help us in terms of what you think it should be. If the committee can improve on the criteria for appointment of the head of the walks, the head of the walks currently, it is not a Chapter 9 institution. So we need to look at it to some extent differently. And I mean, some of the submissions are suggesting that we change the constitution. But if we don't go that route, if the committee can come up with criteria that can clearly define what type of person we are looking for, et cetera, maybe even the appointment process as such, will that address your concerns in that regard? You've made comments about you've got problems in terms of the personnel of the walks having to go through a security clearance. I find that very interesting because currently, basically, your investigators in the NPA, when they were there under the Scorpions, had to do the same thing. We've got people sitting here who come from different departments, Department of Justice, Mr. DeLonger, these people from the State Law Advisors Office, etc., who also have to go through security clearance. And it's not about state security as such. It's about, if I understand it correctly, making sure that the person is not, when appointed to a position, will not be a risk, not to state security, but in that position. They're working with, they're not corruptible themselves, they're not insolvent, they don't have a personal life that can make them themselves be objects of intimidation or even of trying to say, you know, you will do that, otherwise I will tell the whole world that you're doing X, Y, and Z in your private life. That's what it's about, if I understand that correctly. So I just want to get some more clarity on your thinking around this that issue specifically. And I'm raising it because you also raised the issue of the fact that the rest of the staff have are ordinary staff members still in the long term. They have the powers and the privileges of an ordinary member, which I believe is in fact not that bad a thing, given the fact that already under the SAPS Act, if somebody interfered within an investigation of an ordinary police officer, try them to stop their investigation, et cetera, et cetera. It is a criminal offence to do so. So in a way, your argument that you make that, and I'm not saying we can't strengthen it by being more explicit in the legislation, but your argument that you make in terms of interference into investigations is actually, in a way, covered in the SAP Act by making it already a criminal offence, even if it's in terms of investigating a shoplifting case, that if you interfere in that case, you're already criminally liable yourself. So I there are obviously positives and negatives to this, but given that, and if we look at the possibility, and that's why I'm interested in your own suggestions around on how we protect the ordinary members of the Hawks in terms of the the operational structure of the police, in terms of interference, in terms of command and control, given if we can better protect them, don't you think it is to their advantage still to have that ordinary? I mean, I don't even think it's to their advantage. I think they absolutely need to have the ordinary police powers, because otherwise they won't be able to arrest and investigate. So they do need that. I'm also interested, as you are a constitutional expert yourself, I'm interested to find out, Professor, if you can maybe give us insight into why is it that the Glenister judgment refers to the minority judgment as the main judgment on numerous occasions throughout the judgments. There are a couple of places where they actually do this, where they refer to the minority judgment as the main judgment. If you could just maybe add from your expertise, also give us some insight into that. So for the moment, that is all. It might be somewhere.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just a small question, Professor. You start off by saying the drafter had a difficult piece of work to put this amendment together in trying to comply with the order, with the constitutional judgment. And he went on to speak about the issue about the PMFA and the trying to separate in terms of the accountability structure and the national commissioner and so on. And I was hoping that you would have developed that point further in trying to answer it. What could have been an easy task? To obviate a difficult task, because I think there is the challenges. Maybe if you could comment on that. The second question is in relation to accountability. Is it your view that the accountability or the structure of the police as it's set up, the National Commissioner in terms of the Section 207 of the Constitution being the overall responsibility, and the directorate of the Hawks being subordinate to the National Commissioner, is your view that it affects the issue about accountability and the authority and possible interference in terms of the fact that if that one has decided the priorities, you will run the priority without any in between? If it is so, would you think that if you want to break that line, should there be a line directly to the minister responsible to, in this case, the Minister of Police, in terms of the accountability of the director of the special, of the Hawks particularly? Would that be a model that is better in terms of designing it and trying to meet the objective? The Chapter 9 institution. Now, you did comment about, and I know that there are a number of comments in the submission about the Chapter 9 institution. As a constitutional lawyer specialist, would you have thought that, or you think that the most model that would work to effectively and meet the judgment in total would have been the options of the Chapter 9 institution, and if it's so, the issue about constitutionality of the Section 207 in terms of the police, the National Police Commissioner. And the last one is the ministerial committee. You have taken an issue with that particular provision. Is it your view that if the ministerial committee is given the proper mandate in terms of the functionality of it, would you still see it as a problem if the task elder responsibility is clearly defined, we find it still challenging for possible interference through that committee. Just to get your views around it, or do you see circumventing or using the committee? I just want to get your insight of that particular question, because I think it's an important thing that you've raised in the structure of. But let me leave that, because I think the question was posed already by the tenure of office and either coming back or not coming back, and I leave that. I think it's already been posed. Those are a few questions. Thanks.
In your 4.1, you claim that the proposed draft bill falls short of the requirements set up by the judgment because it's kept in the SAPs and answerable to the National Police Commissioner. In your 4.2, you say the judgment suggests that a better model to follow would be the NPA, Chapter 9, etc., accountable to Parliament, but not reporting to a political entity. And you suggest that we create an institution that is accountable to Parliament, does not report directly to a political entity, which of course controls its budget. Now, you say it would be far easier to create an efficient, structurally and operationally independent anti-corruption fighting unit, safeguarded from political interference, or interference as a separate unit. And quite rightly point out, there is no constitutional imperative to having all investigative policing functions performed by the SAP. You refer to the Kampempe Commission and the Potsane case in support, of course. So what are you suggesting in the final analysis? What is the unit you are referring to? Where would it be housed, in that you object to the fact that the draft is aimed at retaining it within the SAP? You've come to many conclusions, but I don't see the punchline. Fill me in, please.
Sorry, just two questions that slipped my mind. The one issue is the issue on the Ministerial Committee as well. The Ministerial Committee's powers have been watered down significantly. Most probably will still be watered down even more. But why is it that nobody has an issue with the NPA, with the Scorpions, having a Ministerial Committee? Because the Scorpions also had a Ministerial Committee. And at that stage, nobody had an issue around that. So why are we finding this? I just want to, for my own mind, to understand the arguments why now there is a problem with the Ministerial Committee, while previously nobody had a problem with that. The second thing is that I'm also interested in your bottom line, as the Honourable Kuala Barnard coined it. Because if you look at the minority judgment, of the Glenister judgment, I think it's section 78. Given the provisions of section 179, I quote from the judgment, given the provisions of section 179 and 205 of the Constitution, in particular the assignment of the powers to investigate crime to the police and the powers to prosecute crime to the NPA, it is indeed doubtful whether the powers to investigate crime can be said to be incidental to the power to prosecute crime. Happily, I want to stress the point, happily, in this case, we do not have to consider the question of whether Parliament had the power to confer full-blown investigative sanctions and powers on the NPA in the light of the provisions of Section 179 and 205.
Thank you very much, members. Probably my question will also be related to the security of tenure. The current bill suggests a fixed term of 7 years. And I think you seem to be agreeing with that. And my question is, what if we have a person who is doing some good job, just asking, and we have to get rid of this person after 7 years and then start looking for somebody else? I'm just asking for the sake of asking, really. But also, if you actually check the majority judgment, referring to, it's point 244. It says we also accept that our legal system requires some level of executive involvement in any area of executive function. We do not quibble with some measure of executive involvement it is its extent and the blackness with which its shadow looms in the absence, in fact, in the absence of other safeguards, that is inimical to the independent functioning of the DPCI. I think the judgment, unless I'm wrong, acknowledges the fact that there will be executive, whether it's MPA or there will be. Can that be correct or not correct? Because if I read it, I think it says that. And indeed, let me leave it at that. But in fact, when I was actually reading this judgment, it is referring to the appointment of the head of MPA by the president, but not referring to the appointment of the national commissioner by the president. Both of them are appointed by the president, and then they both appoint their deputies. I just wanted to say, because I couldn't find it in the judgment, I wasn't sure whether it was an omission or whatever, because this is the way the national commissioner is also appointed by the president.
Thank you, honourable members, for the questions. I'll try and answer them. Maybe I'll just preface it by saying the following. When one has a constitutional court judgment where there's a minority and a majority decision, then what happens is we follow a system of precedent. So what my students always love when I tell them is, the minority judgment is not legally important, because what the minority says is not binding. And the court, even those in the minority judgment, in future cases are bound by the majority judgment and has to follow that judgment, unless there's an overwhelming feeling that a judgment was so preposterously wrong that it has to be overturned, the precedent. So that is the context. The honourable member's question about why they say the main judgment, that this is not the first case in which they do this. And I have no idea actually why they do this, where the minority judgment is the main judgment. I've heard it being said that it is when they sit in the conference and they decide who's going to write a majority and a minority judgment. They give it to a specific judge to write, and then over discussion and so on, some people change their mind. So what might have been a majority judgment might become a minority judgment, but I don't know. But that is legally completely irrelevant, because the majority has now ruled, and now we are, depending on your point of view, stuck with it, or we have to enforce it. And that's the end of the story. On the security of Kenya, I think one must distinguish between how the draft legislation deals with security of Kenya of the head of the investigative unit and of other members. The head, the provisions at the moment says that a person can be appointed for a period of up to 7 years, that can be extended for 2 years if the person reaches the age of 60 before the 7 years is over, at the discretion of the minister. Now, it seems to me that is unnecessarily complicated and exposes the draft legislation to potential attack, because a fixed term security of tenure for the head, whether it's 7 years, or I would prefer actually slightly longer term, 10 years. One doesn't want to have a life term, because one doesn't want any person with that much power to be in the seat for so much time, because there's always the possibility that that person could begin to abuse the power. So in the same way that the head of the National Prosecuting Authority is appointed for a fixed term of 10 years, so should I suspect the head of this body be. On the distinction between the Commissioner of Police and the National Director of Public Prosecution, just as an aside, of course, the distinction is that the head of the National Prosecuting Authority is appointed by the President, but for a fixed term of 10 years. The National Police Commissioner is appointed for a term which can be renewed, and he can be reappointed by the President for another term. As the Constitutional Court found in the much-lamented Jarsa case, in which the President tried to extend the term of office of the previous Chief Justice, Sandile Ngcobo, that extension creates the potential for a perception of political interference, because the fear is that a person who might be reappointed might act in a way to ensure that a reappointment will happen. So that is the distinction. So I would say that for the head of the national body, appointment for a fixed term, not in the discretion of the minister for up to 7 years, but for a period of 7 or 10 years, whatever the term is, and keep it fixed, and that makes it just safe, and not having provisions that if the person reaches 60, that can be appointed for another 2 years with the discretion. That kind of thing leaves you open for constitutional attack. Where the ordinary members is concerned, when its appointments come, the provision in the draft is clear that it will be appointed in effect by the head of this unit, which is perfectly acceptable. The problem comes in the removal, the security of tenure in the removal also, in that the head of the unit can be removed, but there has to be a commission or some kind of inquiry. As I said, one of the criteria that is set out there at the moment, that the person is not acting in an efficient manner, that is too broad and open-ended and too subjective. I would say that what would save that provision is to include, to delete that particular reason for removal from office, and to set out in perhaps a little bit more detail the requirements for the inquiry that needs to be undergone, so that the inquiry has a quasi-legal nature. So that because the reason why it's a protection is because these criteria, fit and proper, whether the person has suffered from ill health, these are objective criteria, which in the law, if it is a quasi-legal investigation, and that could be done by requiring an investigation by a judge or by a retired judge or whatever, then it is a factual situation. It is not an opinion prone to political manipulation. And to have such, and to set that out in the legislation, to say only removal on these objective criteria, that is, in terms of these criteria, if they have been found to be actually existing objectively by the body that is now set out to make that inquiry, that will go a very long way to protect the security of tenure of the head. Of course, there's another problem in that the ordinary members are not protected in any way. In their security of tenure is not protected. I would say that ordinary members need not have the same protection as the head. That would be overkill. But at least the ordinary members who can, in effect, only be appointed on the recommendation of the head of this unit, who will then be independent, could also then not only be the proposal from my side would be, should only be capable of being removed by the head or on the recommendation of the head. That is clearly the case, because at the moment it's the police commissioner that can do that, and for all the for any reason. So for that reason, it's also very important to get the right person in this position, and to make sure that the appointment procedure is such that people trust that person, that the person is, that there are criteria set out for how the person should be, what the qualities of the person is that should be appointed. A person who has experience in investigation, a person of high integrity, those kind of criteria that would guide whoever makes the appointment. My personal choice, as I said in my submission, would be for Parliament to appoint that person with a supermajority of 60%. Now, I know the executive might not like that, but it seems to me that would go a long way to remove, and because one of the biggest problems we have with corruption issue is that it becomes politicized. It is who is being investigated, who's not being investigated, and you know, I'm not going to refer to our past, but this is clearly a problem. And if Parliament, with a supermajority, appoints somebody after a public process, interviews, civil society engagement, that would be my ideal. This is not what is required by the Constitutional Court judgment, I will stress that, but I think that is an ideal. The removal by the two houses of Parliament, I think that section for me could be cured if it is made clear that the two houses could remove, but only after an inquiry. There has to be some kind of inquiry because it has to be objective determination of whether one of those criteria has been met. Otherwise, it is going to be very difficult. The criteria for appointment, as I said, needs to be objective criteria. Whether one is a person of integrity, whether one has sufficient skills to investigate crimes, whether one is has the ability to act impartially. So, for example, I would say that this is not what is required by the act, by the judgment, but I would say that it is even important to put in something like a person who is appointed cannot be in a leadership position in any political party. Obviously, one cannot say that one could never have been in a position in a political party, because given our struggle history, that would exclude so many very capable people. But at the point in time of appointment, that person, I think, shouldn't be allowed to be in a leadership position of any political party. On the security clearance, yes, that's a difficult one. I think it's important that there should be some integrity check on members who are going to investigate corruption. And it is my understanding that in the past, the security clearance was required to be done by the crime intelligence. And there have been some difficulties with the crime intelligence and with the efficiency and also with the... let me just leave it there. And so either it took very long to do the security clearance or it wasn't done as it was envisaged. Ideally, I think calling it a security clearance, I think, is a bit of a difficulty. It's almost like an integrity check that needs to happen. Who's going to do that? I'm not really sure, I must confess. I haven't really thought about that. But some kind of integrity check is, I think, important. But calling it a security clearance can easily sound like a kind of that it could easily be used as a gatekeeping mechanism. So, I think the Honourable Member wants to ask a follow-up question.
I hear what you say. So, what you're basically saying to us is look at the possibility of another agency doing the clearance check. That's the one of the possibility. The problem is if you do not have, there is integrity, there's other integrity measures in the existing Act. For the walks as well. I mean, lie detector tests, drug testing, etc. There's lifestyle audits, etc. that are in the existing Act. But there's another side to this. If you don't have a proper security clearance, and I think we must differentiate between the two, and I just want your opinion on this, another department might then argue that you don't have the sufficient clearance to be investigating this issue of corruption within this department because you don't have the clearance. So, you know, just that, so what I'm trying to say, Chair, and I hear the concern raised by Professor, but I think the reality is also there that we need to find the ideal way to deal with it. So that you can't turn around and say that because you don't have the clearance, that requires the clearance, you therefore now can't investigate a possible corruption case within the NPA for that matter.
Yes, Honourable Member, that's why I said that I think it is very important that such a unit should have members who have the highest kind of security clearance, but also that maybe not all the members need to have, and I'll amend my written proposal slightly, need not have the same type of security clearance, but that everybody needs a kind of minimum integrity check kind of clearance, and some people would need to have a higher kind of clearance to be dealing with those kinds of very sensitive issues, I would say. Just on a point about the members falling within the SAPS at the moment, and one cannot, in terms of Section 67 of the Act, interfere with the investigation. But that is, of course, an interference by somebody from outside. It doesn't deal with what happens if the head of the police or your commanding officer instructs you not to continue. That is a lawful instruction, and that is not going to be caught by Section 67. So that's what so I'm not sure that the existing police sections actually capture exactly what happens in the corruption situation entirely. So, what could have been an easy task to comply with the judgment? Of course, I'm not talking politically, I'm talking just legally and structurally. It would have been easier to create some kind of body that does not fall within the hierarchy and the structure of the police service. Because many of the very difficult questions, which I concede are very difficult, come around because you have a very hierarchical system, you have the Public Finance Management Act and so on, as I've said, and that makes insulating from political influence, but at the same time being part of the system makes it a little bit difficult. So I would say that, as I said, the Constitutional Court, and although the minority judgment disagrees with this, it seems they disagree with their own judgment in the Botswana case, which said that just because a section in the Constitution says there should be one prosecuting authority or one police service doesn't really mean that there cannot be other arms of fulfilling the same task, because what that is really capturing is that we used to have all these absurd homelands, and there were like 11 or 12 prosecuting authorities and police services, and we don't want that. We want one. But it said that doesn't mean, for example, that the military cannot have a prosecuting arm. And so I would suspect that in itself will not make having a unit that is separate will not make it unconstitutional. That will still require, of course, accountability. And that accountability must be accountability both to the minister, the relevant minister, whoever that might be, and to Parliament. The accountability, it seems to me, ideally, to the minister, is the accountability that comes with providing required information, without being required to, but at the same time being protected from a potential pressure being put by the minister on one not to proceed with an investigation, but still having a legal duty to provide the minister with any information, just like the National Prosecuting Authority. While the accountability to Parliament is a different kind of accountability. It's not about the operational accountability as such as about whether the unit is actually fulfilling its task, whether it is efficient, whether it is actually doing what it's supposed to do, namely to prosecute, to investigate and to corruption that leads to successful prosecutions so that the money can be used effectively to help the poor and the marginalized in our society. So that, I think, answers the accountability issue, and I think If you're going to have it inside the police, what is the difficulty is that one will have this individual who, no matter how you throw the dice, this person who's the head of the unit will have sort of some kind of accountability to the head of the police. As the commissioner, have some accountability to the minister, and then some accountability to parliament. It's a very difficult, I'm glad I'm not going to be that person, because it's not going to be an easy task to fulfill. And while at the same time making sure that you are not in any way being influenced by the commissioner to investigate certain people, not to investigate certain people, and so on. Whether it's a Chapter 9 institution, I think this is semantics in a way. I'm not in favor really of changing the constitution personally, because I feel that one must be very careful before one changes the constitution, not that the constitution can never be changed. Constitutions can always be changed, that's why we have Section 77 in the constitution that allows this to happen. But it's not, I don't think, necessary to change the constitution. And create another Chapter 9 institution. When people talk about Chapter 9 institution or the NPA or whatever, it's more like borrowing from the kind of structures that have been put in place and say, well, let's put this in an ordinary piece of legislation and make this compliant with what the Constitutional Court has said is required. And that for me seems to be sufficient. It would be easier to create a different body, but politically that might not be feasible. But then the very difficult issues will have to be addressed of how to create sufficient protection for this unit from political, potential political influence or interference. Okay, the Ministerial Committee and why it was never a problem with the Scorpions. My quick answer would be, of course, that Scorpion's Ministerial Committee actually, in fact, never met. And so, yes. And so, that is the first question, the first issue. The second issue is that piece of legislation was, of course, never challenged before the Constitutional Court. So one can, I think this, if I was in my academic hat on and I critiqued the majority judgment, this is a kind of a critique that I would possibly mention and say, well, is it clear that the Ministerial Committee would interfere or not? I think the reason why the majority found as it did is it's about the perception more than about the reality. It's about the fear that politicians will be able, either directly or indirectly through policy guidelines, be able to influence operationally what's going on here. So, and that's why one can marry the two by saying, well, it's not only about what happens in fact, but it's also about what happens in the perception. Whether one can amend it, I'm not so sure, because the Ministerial Committee, according to the majority of the Constitutional Court, which we have to accept whether we agree with it or not, is always going to be problematic. It's always going to create, at the very least, the perception that there's a potential for political influence or interference. And so I would be in favor, and I think it would be safer, to have accountability to the minister, but the kind of accountability that is circumscribed in the way that I suggested, and then accountability to the relevant committee of Parliament, probably this committee. So accountability to Parliament, I think I've now answered that question. And yes, I think, I don't know if I've answered all your questions, but I hope I have tried to do so at the best of my ability.
No, thank you, Professor. The Ministerial Committee, this one too, never met. Not once. So it never did. As to what that means, I don't know. In terms of the law. Because in terms of the law, they are to meet at least 4 times a year. And that is the minimum. They must. So it never happened. But then thank you very much for the presentation. it is raising, I think, important issues that I think as the portfolio committee, when we process it, we will have to take care of and take note of. And thank you very much. I do believe that you are a phone call away from the portfolio committee. In an event, we want clarity on anything that you raised here today. After you have gone, remember you're dealing with old people sometimes, they don't okay. But I think that you'll probably appreciate. We will take note of the issues that you've taken, we'll consider them, and thank you very much. We'll move on to our next presentation. Huh? Huh? Oh, okay. According to our program, we'll now break for lunch. We'll come back here at 1:30 on the dot.